Here we did not stay long, but passed out once more into the fog and gloom. For some time we walked along the bank of a broad and filthy stream which ran into the great river. With the stream on our right hand we journeyed till we reached a huge city. It was a most dismal place, great chimney stacks everywhere, and factories and warehouses on every side, and between them ran squalid, dirty streets. Filth and grime were everywhere. In and out of the factories moved streams of workmen, and I stopped to inquire what they were doing. One replied, "Working, what do you suppose? But what do you do with the goods?" "Sell them, of course, but the funny thing is that as soon as they are sold they return to the factory from which they came. That's why it is all the factories have so many huge warehouses. We are constantly building new ones to hold the goods. The whole place seems choked with them, can't get clear of the damn things. The factories are constantly getting jammed up with the things that return, and no matter how we try to get rid of them, they always come back." The officer, "Why don't you burn them?" The stranger, "Burn them? Why, we've burnt a dozen great warehouses at a time, but there they are again. Simply can't get rid of the beastly rubbish." The officer, "Why do you go on making the goods then?" The stranger, "We can't help it. We seem driven by some strange force, compelled to work and work without ceasing. There's no rest. A strange, mad instinct seems to drive us on. When I was on Earth I thought of nothing but my work. I worked hard, damned hard, day after day, and this is my reward. On and on and on, doing the same thing over and over again, without rest, forever and ever. I can't make it out." The officer, "I suppose you thought of nothing but your material interests when on Earth, and so in hell you still go on in the same way." The stranger, "Hell? There's no such place, or heaven either." The officer, "Where are you, then?" The stranger, "I don't know, and don't care. Why, look what a number of churches and parsons there are here. But I've no time to stop talking to fools like you. I must get back to my work." And he entered the factory. I went on till I came to a large square, in which were no less than three churches. One belonged to the Church of England, another to the Roman Catholics, and a third to one of the nonconformist bodies. I went into the Anglican church, and I found a service in full swing. The parson was preaching rather a dry sermon. He harped on two themes by turn: one, that people had no business to go to either of the other two churches, and should show more deference to himself as the representative of the national church; two, that they should subscribe more generously to the church and, incidentally, to its vicar. And he glossed these two themes over by platitudes about social reform and helping the material well-being of their fellow creatures, especially those whom he designated as the lower classes. Somehow this part of his theme rang very hollow. Gone West 154. I noticed the congregation paid little heed to the sermon. Some were whispering scandal to their next-door neighbors, others, mostly women, were criticizing the clothing of their neighbors. Several men were talking business, and in one corner two men were arguing violently, so much so that they interrupted the preacher, who glared at them angrily. I went out and visited the other two churches, and found a similar performance in each. We then went on and came to the shopping area. Here we found a similar state of affairs to that in the factories. People came to buy, but the money they gave for the goods returned to them, while the goods returned to the shops almost at once. I asked one shopkeeper where he got the things he tried to sell since the factories could not supply him. He, "Oh, they came here with me. They are the things which were in my shop when I died. Here they stick till I'm sick and tired of seeing them." The officer, "Why don't you give up keeping a shop?" He, "What a ridiculous idea. What on earth should I do without my shop? Why, my whole life has been centered in selling things ever since I was a boy." He turned away in disgust, and began to serve a lady who wanted to buy a new hat, which returned to the shop a few minutes after she had taken it out. Then I went to the council chamber, and found a crowd of men wrangling about improving the town, but after listening for a long time, I came to the conclusion that, though they might talk forever, nothing would ever be done. I passed out of the town and came to open fields. I use the word to describe the place, but it looked more like a piece of waste ground covered with rubbish, and entirely bare of grass. Here there was a stand, and around the field was a dense crowd of people watching what appeared to be a football match. But though the players seemed to try and play, no goals were scored, and nothing really happened. While I was watching, one man walked off in disgust, and was promptly hooted by the crowd. He turned round savagely, and, after using a string of words which I will not repeat, said, "What's the use of playing here? One never scores a goal, and one does not even enjoy running after the ball as one used to do. I'm fed up with the whole thing." As he strode away, I saw a bright stranger come up to him, and knew that soon another soul would escape from hell. Gone West 155, Chapter 31, The Sleepers. We journeyed for some time till we came to a cave, and here I found quite a number of men fast asleep. Strive as I would, I could not wake them. This surprised me, for till then I had never seen anyone asleep in these realms. Having no bodies, we do not require sleep. I questioned my guardian angel, who now had drawn much nearer to me. He looked very sad as he replied, "Son, these were men who stoutly maintained that after death there was no life. They were strong-willed men who, had they believed, might have done much good. As it is, they led many astray, and since they held this view so strongly, they have, as it were, self-hypnotized themselves into a state of coma, from which it is very hard to rouse them. Here they lie, age after age, and while men whom the world considered far worse than they, and who had sunk far lower in hell, have been able to see the error of their ways and progress, they remain unconscious, and cannot learn." The officer, "This is truly terrible. Is there no way of waking them?" My guide, "After long ages the spell grows weak, then there come to them great messengers of light, who, after much striving, do succeed in breaking through their sleep and rousing them. At length we reached a place of deep chasms and beetling crags, and after wandering along at the base of a range of these cliffs we came in sight of a narrow, slippery stairway. As we did so, suddenly a figure came hurtling through the air and fell to the ground in front of us. It sprang to its feet and fled away into the darkness, and was soon lost to sight among the crags and chasms. "Who was that?" I inquired of my guide. "Some unfortunate creature who has offended against the traditions of the 6th Division. They pride themselves on their respectability there, and those who offend too deeply are hurled forth by the outraged inhabitants. Self-righteousness is the besetting sin there. They love to judge their neighbor and to spread scandal. But look, there is the light of the rest house, and soon you will be able to judge for yourself what manner of men dwell in the 6th Division of hell." How painful was the climb up that long, long flight of steps! But ever the beacon light grew stronger, till soon it illumined a path. Though the light hurt, yet I bore it stoically, and soon we entered the haven of refuge. Here I must stop, for it is time for you, J.W., to return. So having said goodbye to both, I, J.W., returned to Earth. Gone West 156, Chapter 32, The 6th Division. A Church and Its Vicar. Letter from the Officer, September 5, 1914. We stayed but a short time in this rest house, which was a large one, before continuing our journey. Once more the fog engulfed us, and we seemed to turn to the right, and soon I saw the grey mass of a city. This city had a high wall on the side overlooking the great precipice, and it was from one of the towers of the wall that the man we saw fall into the 5th Division of Hell had been cast. The town consisted for the most part of modern-looking houses of the dreary, respectable type that one sees in many of the London suburbs. Some attempt was evidently made to keep the place moderately clean, and this was the first division in which this had been attempted. Seeing a theatre, and asking my guide if I might enter it, he permitted me to do so, himself waiting outside. As I entered, I saw one of the inhabitants of the city and spoke to him. He seemed slightly taken aback, and said, "We've not been introduced." "Oh, damn it, what does that matter?" I replied. "Please do not swear," he answered. I apologized, and then asked him what sort of plays were shown in this city. "All sorts, so long as they are not improper. We will not permit any suggestion of impropriety here." Nothing vulgar or immoral is permitted. All our plays and music halls are conducted on the best principles. That's the first time since I've been in hell that I've heard people object to impropriety. He looked pained. I wish you would not use that word. There is no such place as hell, and certainly we are not in it. Oh, don't talk nonsense, I began. All this realm is hell, so what's the use of pretending it isn't? I've been long enough in hell to know that. Stranger, he replied, who are you, and from where do you come? So I told him briefly my history. As I went on, he slowly drew away from me, and at length broke in with, "That's enough, thank you. Either you are a liar or a villain. I know perfectly well I'm not in hell. I suppose I'm still on earth, but anyway, I never have associated with scoundrels, and I am not going to begin now. Good day, and let me give you a piece of advice, which I do out of the kindness of my heart. I always was a kind-hearted man. Don't tell that story to anyone else here, or they will have you thrown over the battlements," and he made off. I went into the theater. A musical comedy was being performed. A poorer show I've hardly ever seen. The music was not absolutely discordant, as it is in the other divisions of hell, but it was feeble stuff. The very worst kind of so-called popular music. Plot there was none, and the whole show was so banal and trashy, that I cleared out at the end of the first scene. I noticed that the audience seemed as bored as I was, but nevertheless they stayed on. Next I tried a music hall which advertised outside that its show was a most refined entertainment. Funny without being vulgar. It certainly wasn't funny, and it certainly was, to my thinking, intensely vulgar, not indecent, but just vulgar. Low comedians of the worst type, vapid songs, silly aimless tricks, in short, absolute trash. Gone West 157, on coming out, which I did very quickly, I came to a concert hall. Here at least, I thought, I may see something worth seeing, or at any rate hear it. But no, of all the banal twaddle, I think that concert was the worst. I left as quickly as I could, and seeing a picture gallery, entered it without expecting much satisfaction, and was not disappointed. All the rubbishy pictures in the world seemed to have been gathered together and hung on the walls of this ugly, pretentious building. I then returned to my guide, who had, as it were, concealed his natural brightness, and, led by him, made my way through mean streets towards the center of the town. Here I entered a very ugly brick church built in the pseudo-Gothic style. A service was being conducted by a fat, slimy sort of parson, who seemed to mouth his words in a succulent, unctuous manner which irritated me intensely. The service was not absolutely discordant or blasphemous, it was merely hollow and unreal. The prayers were gabbled off as quickly as possible, and it was obvious that there was no real belief behind it. It was merely a form carried through by priest and people because it was considered the proper thing to do. I will give you a few of the phrases which struck me in his sermon. Above all, my dear brothers and sisters, you must help to keep this great city clean of every form of vice. Each and every one of you should make it his or her business to watch for evil, to hunt it out and drive it forth. If you suspect that any person is secretly guilty of some vicious practice, do not rest till you discover his or her secret sin. Even if it is someone near and dear to you, it is your duty to denounce it. If you want help or advice in this great work, come to me and tell me what you suspect. Don't wait till the evil thing becomes rampant, strike at once. In me you will always find a ready helper. Do not let any false ideas of honor stand in your way. In searching out evil, you are entitled to use any means. Let me give you an example. A friend of yours does not come to church. You suspect her of carrying on an intrigue with someone else's husband. You should pretend to be sympathetic, you should trap her into a confession if possible. You should warn her husband, above all, you should tell me. He went on in this strain for some time, and ended up with, "And when guilt is established, no mercy must be shown to the guilty members of society. They must be driven out. They must be hurled from the battlements into the great chasm from which there is no return." In conclusion, he announced there would be a social entertainment next day in order to raise funds for church improvements. As I was going out, I heard one member of the congregation say to another, "Both men, what I would like to know is what happens to all the money which he is always raising for church improvements." The other replied, "I'm sure he pockets it, or at any rate most of it." The first man, "Yes, so I think, but what does he spend it on?" The second man, "I suspect that he leads a double life, has a second home, you know." I heard no more, but I determined to go to the social entertainment. In due course I arrived there, and in a sort of church hall found the vicar and his curate surrounded by a worshipping band of females. They hung on his every word, and when they got a chance poured scandal into his ear. Between times they told spiteful tales about the vicar and various female members of his congregation. At length I got a chance of a few words with the vicar alone, and said, "Vicar, I'm going to ask you a plain question between man and man, and you can rely on my discretion. Do you believe in the truths of the Christian religion which you, gone West 158, have to teach, or are you, like so many learned divines, personally convinced the whole thing is a myth? And if so, do you really think there is a God, heaven and hell, and so forth?" He pressed his two hands together and said unctuously, "A great deal turns on what you mean by belief. A clergyman has a great responsibility. He must not say anything which may cause a weaker brother to stumble." I pressed him closely on the point, and at length he said, "Personally, I have long thought that the tale of Christ is a myth, a beautiful myth, and I am sure Saint Paul thought so. I don't think the early Christians ever thought otherwise. They regarded it as a symbol which taught a great truth, just as the ancient Egyptians preached of the death and resurrection of Osiris. I don't imagine for a moment that an educated Egyptian believed that Osiris ever really lived. It was a parable." Unfortunately, the ignorant gradually grew to regard the parable as literally true, and during the Middle Ages this belief became universal. Today we are by degrees recovering the truth and clearing away the dross of superstition, but of course we cannot proclaim these facts from the housetops. Indeed, if we did, we should probably be called agnostics, and turned out of our livings. Still, quietly, we are doing a great work, I said. "If, then, the whole of Christianity is based on a parable, of what use is the church?" He, "Of the very greatest, my friend. It is a great moral force. That is what it was originally intended to be, and in that sphere it can be of the greatest benefit. Oh, I foresee a long life of useful work for the church when freed from all the superstitious accretions which have attached themselves to its ancient form. Many men who at present are disgusted at what they rightly regard as puerile fables will rally to it as a great social factor for the moral uplifting of the masses. I think some people are inclined to lay too much stress on its social value, and overlook the importance of its moral influence, but they are materialists, thank heaven. I am not one of them. I. Do you think there are such places as heaven and hell, and is there after all such a being as God?" He. "With regard to the last point, I think we are not as yet in a position to give a definite answer. We are at liberty to hold our own views. To some people a conception of a God of some sort is necessary, like the parables of Christ, or they would cease to obey the moral law. But, personally, while I would not be so presumptuous as to say there is no God, I do not consider one is essential. I consider that this world is governed by laws, and the moral law is the highest. Those who break the moral law sooner or later are punished by that law, so that I do not see that an arbitrary creator is necessary. But, of course, I should not say this to my flock as a whole." I interrupted the flow of eloquence with, "Still, it is not necessary to conceive of God as an arbitrary autocrat. He may be a wise, all-seeing judge, who coordinates his various laws. He may be, but to turn to the question of heaven and hell, I think I may say frankly I don't believe in either. I consider that each man, roughly speaking, gets his rewards and punishments on this earth either by disease or from his fellow men. Hell I consider a monstrous idea. For my part I should hesitate, of course, to say there is no life after death, but I doubt it." I stared at him for a minute, and then said, "But how did you get here?" He. "In rather a curious way. I was very ill. and at length became unconscious. While I was in this state, I had some most curious and horrible dreams. I won't trouble to describe them, but then I was evidently delirious. When I recovered, I found myself here, gone west 159, without my wife. No one could tell me exactly how I came here, but being here, and finding that the vicar of this church had just disappeared in a most mysterious way, I took up his cure, and have done his work ever since. Everybody is agreed that he must be dead. That's the curious thing about life here. People don't die. I never have a funeral service. They just vanish. I can't help thinking the sanitary authorities dispose of the bodies silently. But, after all, I've other things to bother about. My parish is a fashionable one, in the best part of the city, and I have to devote my whole time to it. But you've married again? Yes. I soon came to the conclusion that while I was ill, my wife must have died, so I had no hesitation in marrying again. Of course, I'm too old to need that sort of thing, but my wife is a great help in the parish, a great help. I'm afraid she is not always tactful, but one can't have everything. Then even you do not realize that you are in hell? What a preposterous question. I then proceeded to give my reasons for knowing we were in hell, and narrated my adventures since I died. He listened very coldly, and at last broke in with, "Thank you, I've heard enough. If I were a swearing man, I should use strong language, but as it is, I will content myself with saying that I don't believe a word you've told me. I'm sorry I have wasted my time talking to such a man. If you are not a liar, then, by your own showing, you are an unmitigated scoundrel. Good day, and I should advise you to leave this city as soon as possible, for although I shall not myself denounce you, being a humane man, others will certainly discover your true character, and then you can expect little mercy." He left me, and a moment later began to tell two women who hurried up to him all about me, so I thought it best to depart without undue delay. Goodbye. I close. Gone West 160, Chapter 33, A Debate in Hell as to Whether There is a Life After Death, Transvision. September 7, 1914. As soon as I reached the house in which H. J. L. lived, I found the officer waiting, and he at once continued his story. After wandering through the city for some time, I saw a building which appeared to be a sort of institute. On looking in, I perceived that there was a kind of debate in progress. It appeared that some missionaries from the higher realms had been holding meetings, and as a result someone had proposed the theme, "Is there a life after death?" One man said, "There is no evidence that men live after death. Some people I know argue that we have died, and therefore since we are now alive, this fact proves that there is a life after death. But this is begging the question. We are alive, and therefore this proves that we have not died. We have all been very ill, and on recovering find the whole earth changed. Look, how grey the sky is, and how dark it is all day." "Yes," broke in another man, "that's why I'm sure we are dead, and I believe we are in hell." "Preposterous," cried the first speaker. "We are just as comfortable here as we were before our illness. I don't believe in hell, but if, for the sake of argument, we admit that there may be such a place, all will agree that this cannot be hell. The parsons taught us that hell is a place of eternal torment, where the worm dieth not and the fire is not quenched. Well, there is nothing of that sort here. We are of course all rather bored with the same endless round of petty cares and troubles, but that is what we always find on earth. There is no anguish of the damned any more than we experience the imaginary joys of heaven. That, to my mind, is one of the strongest proofs possible that we are not dead. If there were such a thing as life after death, it would be entirely different to life on earth. Now this life may differ from life when we were younger, but it is not so entirely different as it would be if we were disembodied spirits. Gentlemen, I move that this house considers that there is no convincing evidence in favor of life after death." I will not detain you with the arguments of his opponent, who maintained that there was life after death. They followed the usual lines which might be expected. The speaker declared that he was sure he had died, and so on. He admitted that he was puzzled where they were, but considered that they were probably in purgatory. Indignant protests from several staunch Protestants, who declared this was popish rot. The chairman intervened, and order was restored. I felt, however, he only half believed his own arguments. The next man who rose had a really ingenious theory, though it failed to convince many of the audience. He said, "I know I died, and this life I believe is just a dream. I suppose our brains go on working for some little time after life is declared extinct. Having lost all real control of the body, it spends its time weaving wonderful dreams. Of course I know this cannot last long, but when on earth, I have often dreamed long dreams, in which days and weeks seemed to elapse, and found out afterwards that I had not dozed for more than 5 minutes. You will say at once, then we are merely the phantoms of our brains. You are right. There is no city, no debating hall, no one but myself. I have dreamed you all. Soon my brain will run down, and then the dream will cease. Look how we go on doing exactly the same things as we did on Earth over and over again like automatons. No, the only life after death consists of the dreams of the dying brain, but I waste my time talking to the creations of my own fancy." And he sat down with a morose frown. Gone West 161. A roar of laughter greeted this speech. Then I sprang up. "Gentlemen, I am but a stranger who has wandered into your city on his journey to another place, but if you will only believe me, I think I can convince you that there is a life after death, and whether or not there is heaven, there is certainly hell, and we are in it. Further, there are lower depths of hell than this, and in them men suffer torments akin to those which are considered proper to hell. Listen to my own adventures since I died." But it was no use. Before I had nearly finished they shouted me down, and several threatened to haul me off to the battlements. As I went out a man followed me, and as soon as I had got out of sight of the building he came up to me and said, "Sir, I know you are right, and as you have worked your way up through so many divisions of hell, you will doubtless escape in the end. May I come with you?" Before I could answer his guide became visible, and said, "My son, I will guide you out of this realm to a place where loving friends will help you. Come, follow me. It was impossible for any to help you till you desired help, but now I may return to you." And they went away together. Gone West 162, Chapter 34. He reaches the seventh division. So I journeyed on alone, led by my own guide out of that city. We passed other cities and villages all very much alike, till at length we reached a high mountain range. Slowly and painfully up this we climbed, and the higher we went the harder and steeper became the path, till at length we reached the top, and saw a short way in front another rest house, larger and finer than any I had seen before. High up towered the building, and from the topmost story a great light beamed forth into the darkness. But the powers of darkness were not going to allow me to escape without one last effort, and suddenly I was surrounded by a howling mob, which tried to drag me back and cast me over the cliff. But I had not toiled so hard and suffered so much to lose heart now, and summoning all my will power to me I hurled my assailants to right and left. Even as I did so my guide stood beside me in all his brightness, and the vile spirits fell back screaming with fear. To me the pain was intense, but I bore it, and stumbling forward fell against the door. Instantly it opened, and kind hands drew me in and the door slammed to. As it did so I heard a yell of baffled rage and hate. Then I heard my guardian angel's voice saying, "Son, for a while you will not see me, but I shall be always at hand." The strangers whom I could not see because of the light led me away into a darkened room. I shall not describe all that happened there. You know already from what J. H. L. has told you. For some time I stayed in the hospital undergoing treatment, which was directed to drawing out of my spiritual form all the gross and evil matter it contained. When this work was completed I had shrunk to the size of a tiny baby. Then they began to build up my frame, and after a short while I was able to take my place in the schools. Here I met P. who showed me the greatest kindness, and though I was one of the worst boys in the school, never ceased trying to help me. When he left the school he particularly urged me to try and follow him, and I determined to do so. But that must wait till Saturday, for it is time you returned. So though I, J. W., was loath to leave them, I departed.